You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 3rd of August 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Muller.
Coming up on today's programme, film critic Tim Robey joins us to discuss some of the latest box office hits, including one of Ryan Gosling's very darkest and broodingest performances, Only God Forgives.
It's a little more complicated than that, Mother.
Your brother would have found your killer, brought me his head on a platter.
Sounds appetizing. We'll also be joined by Italian music maestro Sergio Ricciardone, who'll be telling us about the extremely civilized European idea of the urban festival.
And sticking more or less with that subject, we'll head to Edinburgh for some laughs, reviewing and previewing the annual Fringe Festival, which takes place every August.
And we'll have our usual roundup of must-see cultural events from around the world, with a special hit from our producer, Alla John, who's been on assignment in the Orient this week.
So, lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm here with Tom Edwards for our Saturday review. Tom, have you done anything cultural this week?
Well, Andrew, in preparation for the show, I like to try and, you know, take a bit of stock of the cultural landscape here in London. And I actually headed to the Barbican, one of my favourite cultural hubs here in the city, last night to see you probably, you know me fairly well. You'd imagine I'd go to some contemporary classical music.
That is one of the things I would imagine.
The first thing you'd think. Yeah. Ludovico Einaudi, the Italian composer, hails from Turin, of course. Most notable, in my opinion, because he looks exactly like Larry David. So I couldn't sort of get that image of him being Larry David out of my mind, even while he was tinkling the ivories. Very good job he did too. Though I would say I did expect his music to be punctuated by sort of strap lines from commercials, because I think he's licensed quite a lot of his works for advertising. So between songs, with the applause, I kind of expected to be told about the merits of, for example, Pirelli rubber, for example. but it was a very good show, even though it's quite interesting because it's quite a small, he has quite a small band. It's only about a dozen performers, and they obviously all amplified, which is a bit, it's a very different sort of acoustically that experience. You know, ordinarily in a venue, say like the Royal Albert Hall, you'd watch orchestral work. It would not be amplified, and it's that amazing natural resonance, the scale of it. And you don't get that at Barbican. It's quite a large venue. And with just 10 musicians, they had to amplify, which I thought it was interesting how different that made the experience of listening.
It would. It is a beautiful room, though, that big concert hall at the Barbican. Things do usually sound very good in there, whatever they are. I haven't seen so many Italian pianists in there. It tends to be more American country singers, but it does nonetheless always sound
really good. And acoustically good? It still works for you?
Yeah, terrific.
Have you got a favourite sort of concert performance there that you recall?
I've seen Steve Earle there, Randy Newman there, and the Go-Betweens. I saw record their live album, Live in London, at Barbican.
That's music history in the making, right there.
I recommend the sleeve notes on that album, especially. You are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24.
Now, on a beautiful summer's day, beneath a cloudless sky, serenaded by birdsong, I often think to myself, why not head into a chilled, darkened room and expose myself to 2 hours of blood-curdling violence, intense physical trauma, and jet black psychosexual suffering. That's right, it's movie time!
Except for those of us who get enough of all of that at home. A man who is clearly a connoisseur of the macabre, mysterious, and downright murderous is film critic Tim Robey. Tim, summer just too bright and breezy for you? This is a gruesome selection you have brought to us this week.
Have I? Yes, you're right. And I don't know if it's on purpose. I don't know. Maybe I'm just feeling brutal. But yes, you're right. These are dark films for dark times.
Yes, so listeners should be prepared to have their blood well and truly curdled over the next few minutes. Talk to us first about this new Ryan Gosling film, Only God Forgives.
So this comes from the director of Drive, Nicholas Winding Refn, and the two of them obviously paired up there with a hyper-stylized and very popular kind of quite bloody revenge tale. This is like that film's evil twin, in that it doesn't really have the kind of narrative momentum. It's set in Bangkok. Gosling plays this character whose brother is murdered in the first sort of 10 minutes as an act of revenge because he's just killed a prostitute. He's, in fact, he's killed the young daughter of a kind of brothel owner.
Okay, I'm already feeling like I need a notepad.
Yeah, and probably a shower, actually. But all the plot is packed into the first 10 minutes, and from then on, it's just a series of kind of confrontations, killings, torture scenes, and long stares.
But that's brilliant. The idea of like packing all the plot into the first 10 minutes. So that divides up the audience nicely. If you want the plot, get there on time.
Indeed.
If all actually you want is lots of screaming and mayhem and Ryan Gosling looking broodingly into the middle distance.
And a lot of neon.
And a lot of neon.
It does look tremendous, I must say. But it's almost like we're being punished for getting a kick out of Drive. I think the director is kind of saying, yeah, but look, this is about sadism. And so I'm going to really put you through it. And it's so, it's, Ryan Gosling, despite being the main character, probably has 10 lines of dialogue in the movie. He is like Mr. Laconic in it as well. The kind of notable appearance of Kristen Scott Thomas half an hour kind of pushes up the energy level. She's playing his mum, who is a completely psychopathic bitch, basically. She's like Clytemnestra. And she, it's kind of weird seeing Kristen Scott Thomas play that sort of role.
I just wonder, I mean, it's interesting you referred to it as the evil twin of Drive, because I thought Drive was its own evil twin in the first place. I mean, some of the violence in that movie did sort of lapse into the almost kind of pornographic. And I wonder, are you convinced by the justification of Winding Refn that, you know, it's a study of revenge or anti-revenge study, and it's not about satisfying, as you said, the kind of lurid curiosities of some of his fans from his earlier pictures. Do you buy that?
I don't think he uses that justification on its own, because he also admits that he sees himself as a pornographer. He just says, look, I put on screen stuff that turns me on, stuff that I want to see, stuff that kind of interests me or kind of freaks me out, and expects to get a similar response from his viewers. But a lot of people have really taken against this film. It was very controversial in Cannes. It got some really bad reviews, which I think he relishes. I think he kind of wants to provoke an extreme reaction one way or the other. It's hard work, though, and I think the kind of disjointedness of the plot feels like gratuitous in a way. It's like it could have worked. It could have actually been a really interesting movie. And instead, it's just these series of tableau and like horrible sort of scenes with people being stabbed with multiple needles. And it just gets a bit much.
We do have a clip from Only God Forgives. It goes like this.
I know it's hard for you emotionally.
Your brother was murdered.
When?
Yesterday.
Did you get the guy that did it?
It's a little more complicated than that, Mother.
Meaning what exactly? Your brother would have found your killer, brought me his head on a platter. I have a very special relationship with my son. He's a very dangerous boy.
Just in time for the school holidays.
She's actually Salome, isn't she? She's not Clytemnestra. She wants the head on a plate.
Only God Forgives sounds like an absolute barrel of chuckles. The first choice of the new releases brought to us today by...
I did offer you The Heat. Sadly, you had the delightful stylings of Sandra Bullock, I think you'd covered on a previous show. But
that is a shame.
Yeah.
The next film that you wanted to talk about is The Conjuring. And this is based on a true story, which is yet not a true story. This is based on Ed and Lorraine Warren, alleged paranormal investigators best known for having been behind the Amityville horror phenomenon stroke obvious risible hoax, depending on which way you want to look at these things. Does this film, The Conjuring, take them at their word, or...?
It kind of does, but it doesn't really matter whether you believe in it as a true story or not. It just doesn't matter. It basically is a very enjoyable, formulaic throwback to that kind of 70s haunted house horror movie. It is the Amityville horror again, really.
Does somebody unmask a ghost at the end and reveal that it was the janitor all along?
It's not Scooby-Doo.
That is a shame.
Yeah, it's pretty effective. It's the guy who made Insidious. That was his last big hit, James Wan. And he actually was the director of the first Saw film as well. So he's kind of gone through the shift where he started out you know, that was the first movie in the torture porn subgenre of horror. But he's moved away from that, and he's gone back to these kind of old school supernatural fright fests, which I think he's better at. And this one, it does work. And the thing that keeps it going is the cast, actually. It's a really smart cast of, like, not big stars, but smart stars. Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson play the investigators. They're both terrific. And Lily Taylor, who we haven't seen in a good role in a film for many years, is one of the couple that they're kind of looking after and trying to exercise. And she's great in it too. I actually think it's pretty good. It's been very successful in America. It's made more money than a lot of the kind of bigger blockbusters this summer, because people were in the mood for some scares, I think.
I mean, Lily Taylor's terrific. I've seen her a lot, and she has some pretty prominent roles on TV.
She's better in TV these days, yeah.
Yeah, she's really strong. Do you think there is still, then, you talk about its box office, there's a marketplace, isn't there, for these? You said it's kind of unashamedly old school horror, sort of horror shocks. Lots of frights and, you know, faces appearing in windows and mirrors and that kind of thing. Do you find that, I mean, is it hard to do anything sort of genre-defying with that kind of movie? Like, haven't we seen every one of these shocks and set pieces before? Or do you think if it's carried off with a bit of a LAN, and certainly with actual good acting talent, it can still raise it up to another level?
Yeah, those four lead actors, Ron Livingston is the fourth one, they actually give us real characters. And if you don't care about what's happening on screen, I generally find in a horror movie you're not interested and you're not scared. But if you actually are involved in some way with these relationships, then it works. The other thing is, this one is very playfully retro. You know, it's kind of playing up the 70s clothes and the look. You've got the zombies on the soundtrack. You've got all sorts of things. And I think it does all that pretty nicely. The one thing I really didn't like is that the director gives himself a cameo, which becomes this ridiculous kind of supporting turn, where he kind of comes in and he's among the team who are trying to exercise the house and just, like, but stick that, to the day job, man.
That in itself is a homage to classic horror anyway, isn't it? That's the Hitchcockian trope.
It's the Hitchcockian trope, but Hitchcock only appeared for like a second in his films. This guy, James Wan, has like a 20-minute role, and every one of his scenes, you're watching it thinking, deleted scene, deleted scene, deleted scene.
We have a clip, I believe, of The Conjuring as well.
All right, it's 9:18. We're headed down into the cellar where the door's just opened on its own. Give us a sign that you want to communicate with us.
What are you guys?
Well, we've been called ghost hunters, paranormal researchers.
But we prefer to be known simply as Ed and Lorraine Warren.
We have to get out of here.
That's not going to help.
This thing has latched itself to your family.
Father, we've never seen nothing like this.
I'm coming with you.
No way. I can't lose you.
There's a lady in a dirty nightgown that I see in my dreams. She's standing in front of my mom's bed.
That clip from The Conjuring, which I think it sounds, and I don't necessarily mean this as a criticism, it sounds like hogwash, but knowing hogwash.
It's knowing hogwash. Yeah, that's good. That's a good way of nailing it.
There's a quote they can have from the posters. This is hogwash, but it's knowing hogwash. Monocle 24.
They'll be pleased if they see that your name beneath that, Andrew. I don't know about that kind of horror. I'm not sure I've got the stomach for it. Even when I was a little younger, which is presumably their target demographic, I was never that into the thing of being scared. I don't mind being challenged in the style of Winding Refn, but the actual fear, the jumps, I'm not, are you, I mean, does
it
that
is a
work
bit like someone, it's a bit like the director creeping up behind you and kind of like poking you in the ribs every 10 minutes or so.
I'm nervous enough anyway without that adding to my problem.
Don't see it in that case.
the next selection you have
oh,
brought
God.
Along. and that's there is an introduction right there. This is Paradise Hope.
Shall I just start with this? Okay, so this comes
Please.
From an Austrian director called Ulrich Seidel, who is famous for his provocation and for presenting on screen shots of lots of very overweight Austrians having sex and this being kind of hell on earth. So his films are challenging. This is the third part of a kind of trilogy called the Paradise Trilogy that he's made. One, Paradise Love, Paradise Faith, and this is now Paradise Hope. And you're expecting, oh, well, we're in for an ironic title here, given this director. The weird thing is, it actually is his most accessible film. It's set in a fat farm for young, overweight Austrians. And basically, you're expecting it to be bleak as all get out. But it's not, because he casts these young girls in it who are really funny, really real, and very convincing. And they kind of, their banter and their kind of relationships are extremely well played. And basically, they actually get the better of the situation. They're not you know, stamped on by this institution which they're in. They actually win, in a way. And I think that makes it his... It's sort of like a gateway Ulrich Seidel movie. It's the Ulrich Seidel movie you could recommend to kind of a broad art house audience.
And it's got some of his sort of signature style, hasn't it, in terms of the look and feel of the movie. I mean, there's sort of aspects of that almost kind of Lars von Trier, sort of almost verite style. Do you like, as an actual filmmaker, aside from the merits of this movie and how, relatively upbeat it is, do you sort of appreciate his visual style? It's quite particular.
It is, yeah. I didn't get on with him. The first couple of films of his I saw, I didn't really get on with. But I think I might like them now, looking back, if I rewatch them. He keeps the camera very still on what's happening. What's happening is usually quite grotesque, borderline gross. Here, though, it's also funny. And I think he's at his best when he's at his funniest. And that's what kind of keeps this movie going along. The young actresses in it, Melanie Linz and Verena Leerbauer, both fantastic. Some of the best acting I've seen in a film this year. They're kind of there. You know, the camera's still, and we're in this grim institution, and we're expecting kind of hell. And instead, we actually get, you know, young girls trying to break out of it.
Should we take a bit of a listen to an extract from this movie?
Let's do exactly that.
If you're happy and you know it, clap your fat. If you're happy and you know it, clap your fat. If you're happy and you know it.
Boah, ich mag Uwe seine Augen, wie steppert. Die sind so schön. Was hat er denn für Augenfarbe? Blau, so richtig himmelblau, das ist so schön.
Raus mit euch!
That clip there from Ulrich Seidel's Paradise Hope, which it is a love story of sorts.
It kind of is, although there's a sort of creepy doctor in the institution who...
Of course,
yeah,
there's
naturally,
a creepy doctor.
And he conforms more to the sort of Ulrich Seidel movie you're expecting, in that there's sort of creepy goings on between him and the heroine. But again, that has an outcome that you don't see coming, and I think it's quite a lively and kind of fun movie for an Ulrich Seidel movie. I would say see this one first if you're a newcomer to his work. I could, of course, have offered you Smurfs 2 this week. I feel bad that
Smurfs
I didn't
two.
Give you the Smurfs 2. But,
well,
yeah.
See, there would be no point because I haven't seen Smurfs 1.
Oh, well, you would miss everything.
And so I think that there's just a lot
you wouldn't
of stuff
have any idea what was going on.
Really? Yeah. There's a Smurfs 2?
There's a Smurfs 2, yeah.
Is it notable in any respect at all, apart from just having lots of annoying small blue people?
If you need to see Brendan Gleeson, you know, cuddly Irish actor Brendan Gleeson.
Very, very talented.
Very, very
Irish
great
actor.
Actor Brendan Gleeson falling naked out of the sky, covered in Smurfs, into a dumpster. And then having Smurfs kind of clamber up from beneath him, one of them says, "I have seen unspeakable things down there." Then, you know, then go and see the film.
That sounds like it's worth the admission.
That's almost Ulrich Seidel-esque, actually.
Does anyone sing "If You're Happy and You Know It, clap your fat in Smurfs 2?
The Smurfs aren't fat enough, are they? They ought to be fatter than that, yeah.
It's just like Brendan Gleeson, the very talented and yet at the moment clearly underemployed Irish actor.
He gets
actor.
Some very nice linen suits in that film. I'm sure he got to keep them.
Or at least
them.
Very talented Irish actor who urgently needs to have a word with his agent.
Possibly. I think it sounds good, though. I'd probably rather see Smurfs 2 than the creepy director jumping out at me movie, to be honest.
Okay.
More my bag.
Of those three films, which is your pick of them? Which one would you recommend?
I really enjoyed The Conjuring. I think Paradise Hope is the best film of the three, but The Conjuring is kind of a fun kind of Saturday night multiplex entertainment, which I think, you know, anyone who knows what they're getting from that kind of movie will be satisfied by it.
Yeah. Okay. Tim Robey, thank you so much for joining us here again on The Review. Up next, we'll have Monocle's weekly guide to the best cultural offerings from around the globe by Nelly Gotcheva. Do stay tuned.
The ancient practice of agriculture meets modern metropolis as we explore groundbreaking urban farms in Tokyo, Brooklyn, and Oslo. Monocle Films visits the people bringing green growth to their thriving cities.
Everywhere you look, something is growing. There's Japanese pumpkin and bitter melon dangling from trellises, and eggplant sprouting in the lobby. Tomatoes hang from a conference room ceiling, and papaya and passion fruit trees double as partitions for meeting areas.
Seeds in the City, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
You're with The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Muller. It is time now to cross to Monocle's associate editor, Nelly Gotcheva, to hear some cultural treats she's dug out from around the world for us this weekend.
Mm-hmm. In Sao Paulo, the beautiful premises of the White Cube Gallery play host to Magnus Plessen's first solo exhibition in Brazil. The collection of 6 canvas pieces, along with other works on paper, showcase Plessen's development towards more abstract compositions. The show is on until the 24th of August. Limassol in Cyprus welcomes the 8th edition of the Lemesis International Documentary Festival. On show at Teatro Ena are 27 documentaries from around the world. For this Saturday, we recommend The Machine Which Makes Everything Disappear by Georgian director Tinatin Gurciani. The film won the directing award for World Cinema Documentary at Sundance this year. For more details and screening times, go to filmfestival.com.cy. In Hong Kong, the Blind Spot Gallery hosts Another Mountain Man's latest exhibition of photographs recreating the iconology of classical Chinese painting. The works allude to the art of Bada Shanren, a master painter from the late Ming to early Qing dynasties. Entitled From Xu Shi to Bada Shanren, the exhibit is on until the 24th of August. Psycho No. 3 exhibition by Indonesian artist Aga Suwaji is now on at ARNDT Gallery in Berlin. Through the use of mixed media installations and paintings, Suwaji invites viewers to explore the 3 aspects of the psycho: birth, death, and renewal. Psycho No. 3 is on until the end of August. For more details, visit arndtberlin.com. And finally, the Grove Music Festival is taking over Toronto this weekend with a selection of the world's finest indie, electronic and hip-hop acts. On the lineup are London's Hot Chip, California's Waves, Toronto's Nightbox and fresh from France, our festival favorites, Phoenix. And now let's hear them. It's Phoenix with Entertainment. What you want and what you do to me. From Monocle in Toronto, I'm Nelly Gotcheva. I'll take the trouble that you have.
That was Entertainment from Phoenix's 5th album, Bankrupt, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva, our Toronto bureau chief. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. It's time now for our weekly music review. And here in the UK, the festival season is in full swing, with throngs of cardigan-clad folk music enthusiasts, juggling workshop conveners, wearers of stupid hats, and gluten-free noodle merchants heading off to the boondocks every weekend to stand around in knee-deep mud, and what they hope is knee-deep mud, watching terrible bands play on stages two-thirds of the way to the horizon. But over in continental Europe, things are done a little differently, which is to say, much better.
Sonar in Barcelona led the way for the Urban Festival, utilising full-time and temporary spaces for revellers who want to catch the festival spirit, but not trench foot. The kind of festival you could happily wear a mauve suede slip-on to without fear or regret. Or at least, no more fear and regret than should normally attend the wearing of said mauve suede slip-ons. Our music guest today is Sergio Ricciardone, the man behind Club to Club International Festival of Music and Arts, which takes place in November in Turin, or Torino, as it's otherwise known. Sergio, welcome to The Review.
Hello, thanks. Thanks for having me.
No, it's a pleasure to see you. Now, tell us, what brings you to London? Are you sort of spreading the word about the festival? Is that the main objective?
Well, the truth is that you have the market here, so I have to come here and say hello. this is the truth.
In doing that, allow us to help you do that. Introduce the festival to our listeners. Tell us about it.
Yeah, Club to Club. Well, actually, I'd like to speak about Torino before Club to Club, because Torino, I think, is the Italian best kept secret. Because every time I meet some like London friend, or they always tell me about Florence, Venice, Rome, Milan, but Torino is actually one of the best cities in Italy. It's very close to Berlin altitude. It's a sort of laboratory for contemporary arts and architecture and culture. So it's Club to Club reflects the soul of the city. It's a festival. It's an urban festival, as you were saying before. Focus on music and arts.
And what is it, just staying on Torino, what is it about the city that allows it to be such a sort of a creative environment? Is it just a change in the attitude? Is it because people are just allowed to get on with their work? Why is it such a good creative place?
Well, it's part of the story of the city. Torino's got different souls. It was the first capital city of Italy because of Savoy heritage. And then they decide that they had to unify Italy. So Torino was the first capital. Then we had all the industrial part of the stories, actually, after Fiat decided to do cars in Italy. And because of like doing a lot of startups, actually, it's still in the soul of the city to create something that doesn't exist. Milan is much better than commercializing it. We are more like focusing on new projects. Actually, fashion was fashion in Italy starts in Torino before Milan. So even cinema, Torino was the first city for cinema. So this is part of the story of the city. And I don't know. Actually, it's just the humus of the. You call humus? I don't know the word in English. Like the soul.
Soul will do.
Yeah. That's the point.
Soul's
the
word.
Soul is the word. You've brought some music for us to listen to. At least one of which is actually playing at your festival this year. This is Fortet. Do you want to introduce Fortet to us?
Yeah. Kieran Hebden is actually one of our favorite artists. He was playing at the festival another two times in the past, and he's an amazing artist. He's actually, for me, it's the zeitgeist of artists of electronic music now. He's like the one who represents better the new trends in electronic music. So okay. He will be headlining the festival in Torino.
Let's hear Kieran Hebden, aka Fortet, with Sing.
So that was Fortet then here on the review. Sergio, just tell us a little bit more about the sort of the structure of the festival. How does it work? Will sort of connoisseurs of summer festivals understand the layout and how it all fits together? Or is there a bit of a different approach? Because we know that
it's completely
differently there.
Yeah, it's completely different. It's an urban festival, as you were saying before, that reflects the urban nature of the city. We take over of like different venues through the city. They are completely different one from each other, and they are part of the story of the city. Like we do the headquarters during the day in a very important art foundation called Fondazione Sandretto, and they're having an exhibition in London at the moment. We do like an opening concert in a Baroque theater of the 17th century where actually Paganini was playing. So
wow.
This is something good. And also Nietzsche, that used to live in Torino in the last years of his life, used to go there and to see plays and concerts. And we take this theater once a year for a like opening concert. Then we have a big, big warehouse. It's like an industrial cathedral where they used to build locomotives. And we have an ex factory from Fiat for the final event. We have a primary school where we do a club night. And yeah, this is like we try to have a different venues, extraordinary locations more than having mud
and grass. It sounds so much nicer than camping in Cow Paddock in Somerset. It really, really does.
We really have nice hotels too.
I'm just about sold already. Your second selection, musical selection today, Sergio, this is Factory Floor. Are they playing this year?
Yeah. They're playing at the opening event during the night in this warehouse called OGIR. And they're playing together with Dinos Chapman, who's playing just before them. I already had them like a couple of years ago, not at a festival, but some associated events, because I'm a big fan of the band. I think they are really, really good.
Okay, well, let's hear them. This is Factory Floor with Turn It Up.
So that was Turn It Up from Factory Floor. You mentioned Dinos Chapman there as well. So, I mean, this is very much about arts and where sort of art and music and where all of those creative processes meet together.
Yeah, we try to combine, if you look at the payoff of the festival, it's an international festival of music and arts. It sounds a bit pretentious, but actually we try to find the right combination between music and arts. And that's why we like to work with artists that are also belonging to the contemporary art world. I'm thinking about Dinos Chapman. Carsten Nicolai is playing too with his new project, Diamond Version, that is amazing new project. And Nico Vascellari, the guy who's fronting Niños do Brasil. Nico Vascellari is a very important contemporary artist in Italy, working with Marina Abramovic and a lot of very good artists. So we try to have this kind of artist that like they like beauty. Like, can I say beauty?
Yeah, definitely.
So it's not all about music, it's also about beauty.
On the subject of the music, though, how narrow a focus do you like to keep for the festival? Is it mostly electronica or exclusively electronica?
Not at all. Actually, you get the idea that it's more electronic because we come from there. But we try to combine... Actually, the two elements we try to combine is as... There was a very good review for what they say, not like from Accelerator in the US, and they were saying that our festival was trying to find the third way between pop and avant-garde. We tried to combine pop and avant-garde together. It's more about these than electronics or bands, or we could have bands. I mean, electronic is, for me, it doesn't mean anything to say electronic now because... everyone is electronic now.
Well, the third track you've picked for us today, this is Diamond Version. Do they combine pop with avant-garde, or are they something else entirely?
No, I think they combine entirely pop and avant-garde because of their visual approach and the music they compose. They will be playing for our preview in London, at Village Underground, on the 19th of September. It's a London premiere. I really invite the people listening to the show to come and see the show more than listening to the music.
Okay, well, this is Diamond Version with Empowering Change.
but
went a bit quiet there for a second, which always makes radio presenters incredibly nervous. That was Diamond Version with Empowering Change. Your fourth selection today is Nunos do Brasil. Tell us about him, they, them, he, she, it.
It's the band fronted by Nico Vascellari, the guy I was talking before, this contemporary Italian contemporary artist, amazing guy, very, very forward-thinking. And this is a new project for me, from him, and we premiered this also in London on the same show with Diamond Version of Village Underground. I think it's a combination of Italian traditional pop, Brazilian music and techno.
Okay, well, we will use it to play you out. Sergio Ricciardoni, thank you for joining us. That's Sergio Ricciardoni from the Club to Club Festival, which is happening between the 7th and 10th of November in Torino later this year. And this is Nunos do Brasil with Tupelo. That was Nunos do Brasil with Tupelo, and it's time now on the review to cross to Istanbul to hear what's coming up there over the coming days. Monocle 24 producer Alan John is there and filed this report.
If you're looking for a city that combines Western nightlife, fine dining and retail with conspicuous Eastern cultural heritage, you'd be hard-pressed to find it in such abundance as in Istanbul. Turkey's sprawling metropolis is bursting with the lot. We don't need no education. For a taste of anti-establishment, anthemic progressive rock from years gone by, head down to Istanbul Technical University Stadium this Sunday. Co-founder of Pink Floyd, Roger Waters, continues his international tour in Turkey, bringing with him, funnily enough, a 110-metre-long wall to keep him company on the stage. What with the current climate of protest in Istanbul and Turkey, it's sure to be a lively encounter. If you're somewhat perplexed by hearing the call to prayer go out whilst you enjoy a cool beer or fruity cocktail on a midtown terrace, then continue down the rabbit hole of East meets West cultural mishmash that is Istanbul with a visit to the Sakip Sabancı Museum in the northern part of the city. The ongoing exhibition, 1001 Faces of Orientalism, aims to rise above the West to East polarisation as studied in Edward Said's book Orientalism, published in 1978. The private art collection hopes to consider this phenomenon from outside the European context and distinguish its multiple and contradictory aspects. Wednesday evening will be a time to take stock and enjoy the city's quieter moments of the calendar as the public holiday of Bayram begins as the sun sets. So we'll kickstart 3 days of national holiday to mark the end of Ramadan, and as the city's denizens shut up shop for the week, many will flee the confines of town and head to the coast, or recline in the family home to eat, drink and, well, eat some more in celebration of the so-called Seker Bayramı or Sugar Feast. Head down to Sultanahmet to witness the lighting of the Blue Mosque or enjoy the festival atmosphere of the city. And what better way to celebrate the start of the Eid festivities than by visiting the outdoor Park Orman venue to revel in the moody but soulful tones of British black-clad indie group The XX. I saw you. The band are playing as part of Vodafone's Istanbul Calling, and continue touring their second album, Coexist, released in 2012. Should the night still be young, it's a train and or a taxi into the centre as the Parkhamon venue is in the north of the city. But for the more adventurous, take a cab to the Besiktas ferry and head to Üsküdar to sample the treat at the Agia Hotel restaurant looking over the Bosphorus. For Monocle, in Istanbul, I'm Alec John.
You're with The Review here on Monocle 24. Andrew, I noticed you were hurriedly already booking your ticket to Istanbul to take in the wall.
No, I was actually doing something else entirely.
Oh, don't know what gave me that impression. We'll be back in just a moment with Bruce Dessau, who's in Edinburgh for the annual Fringe Festival. Stay tuned.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes bodacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nous by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world. The Entrepreneurs, the living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
And welcome back. It is Saturday and you are listening to The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Tom Edwards. We're sort of sticking with the subject of festivals for the next item, but this one's okay as well because, like the Club to Club Festival in Torino, it occurs largely indoors, in buildings which are situated on paved roads, the accommodations have running water, and it all takes place in one of Europe's most beautiful cities.
We could only be speaking, of course, of the Edinburgh Festival, and specifically of the adjunct to it, the Edinburgh Fringe, which, since its inception in 1947, has steadily grown to overwhelm its host. Indeed, the Edinburgh Fringe is now the largest arts festival in the world. Last year, I've been counting, Andrew, 2,695 acts participated.
And this year, Bruce Dessau is among those trying to see as many of them as possible. Bruce is the comedy critic of London's Evening Standard and editor of comedy website Beyond the Joke, and he joins us now from Edinburgh. Bruce, how is it going so far?
Hello there. Well, I've managed to find a brief window between trying to see every single one of these shows to talk to you. It's crazy here. It's lovely weather, but it's the kind of weather where you kind of need flip-flops and a woolen coat and an umbrella at the same time.
Typical Edinburgh weather then.
You go into a show and it's sunny, you come out and it's torrential rain. It's crazy. Yeah.
Bruce, tell us then, of what you've seen so far, I know we're still kind of in previews largely, anything sort of absolutely mind-numbingly brilliant, or are you just or generally satisfactory so far?
It's more than satisfactory, not quite mind-numbingly brilliant, but I think as it's on for 3 weeks, and as it goes, you can already sort of sense sort of people, you know, contenders for awards. I saw a show by someone who was nominated for the Foster's Award last year, James Acaster. I saw him last night. He's got an even better show this year, so I think James Acaster, he's almost like, it's hard to describe on the radio, he's like the Jarvis Cocker of comedy. He's very physical, he's a skinny guy who wears sort of chainstock or jumpers and slacks, but he sort of throws himself around on stage. And his show, it's an odd subject for comedy, but he mounts a very persuasive argument to argue that Yoko Ono did not split up the Beatles. As I said, you can see any type of show in Edinburgh, and it is very funny.
Well, I did want to ask about that. Have you yet seen one of those definitive Edinburgh Fringe shows, which are usually the ones you find yourself watching in a crowd of about five, in a basement about 4 o'clock in the morning, watching something completely inexplicable that you cannot persuade yourself can possibly have been the product of sentient human imaginations?
Well, it's funny, I heard in your intro you said that the venues here have running water, and actually, yes, I went to a venue that had running water. It was running down the walls inside the venue. It's, you know, there's a venue, it's called the Caves, and It is. I mean, it's weird. It's like you're underground in the middle of Edinburgh, and I'm sure it's passed all the requisite health and safety rules, but it is quite, you know, I stepped through a puddle as I was going into the show. But it was a sketch duo called That Pair, and actually, they're newcomers. I didn't know them before, and it's actually, I think, a sketch duo, female duo, lots of different characters, music, comedy. I think they're one to watch, but it's an interesting venue as well.
Bruce, let's look at some of the sort of, I guess, some of the bigger shows, the bigger names. What's going to be making the headlines for the right or wrong reasons, in your view?
Well, again, it's an international festival. You know, everywhere you turn, there's a different act. There's a Japanese clown act, kind of mime act, called Gamaja Bat, who are very good. They were here a few years ago, and they're back. Omid Jalili, who's a London-based Anglo-Iranian comedian. Omid's known as a stand-up comedian, but he's appearing in a stage version of The Shawshank Redemption, which was on in London a few years ago. It's different to the film. It's based on the Stephen King novel of The Shawshank Redemption. So it's not quite the same, but that's interesting. It also co-stars Ian Lavender, who people of a certain vintage might know as...
He was Pike, wasn't he, from Dad's Army? Good heavens.
Yeah. But again, it's not a comedy. It's got comic elements, but it's a serious play. From the comedy side, you've got Alexei Sale, who, you know, made his name in the 80s as one of the original alternative comedians. And Alexei Sale has sort of made what I guess you'd call a comeback in the last year or so after a long time away from stand-up. He's doing a show here, which has been very well received in previews, so I'm looking forward to that. John Lloyd, who I think you had on your show a few weeks ago, the TV producer who made Blackadder, Spitting Image, QI, he's not doing stand-up comedy. He's talking about his career in comedy, but that's particularly interesting now because he worked a lot with Mel Smith. He made Not the 9 o'clock News. So I'm seeing that this afternoon, actually. That's John Lloyd. So, yeah, something for everyone. And, of course, Andrew, am I allowed to mention that I've reviewed you at the Edinburgh Festival?
You have, a couple of years ago, and mercifully kindly, which is, of course, why you're on the show.
I knew it would pay off in the end, but that's just an indication of how everything is here. You never know what's going to be on at the Edinburgh Festival. So maybe I'm seeing people here in the afternoon playing in wet venues that in 2 years' time will be interviewing me on the radio.
Do bear that in mind. You said I believe you've seen a preview, and I wanted to ask specifically about Alexei Sale's show, rather, because he's returning kind of in the guise of the elder statesman wanting to show the whippersnappers how it's done. I believe you've seen a preview of this show. Does it work?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, when he first emerged in the 80s, he was sort of bouncing around on the stage and, you know, like a bunny rabbit. He had a lot of energy and a lot of anger. And he's now, I think he's just about 60. He's probably... I don't know if mellowed is the right word, because he's still angry, but he's not shouty. He's more of a kind of mellow, furious, but mellow. And so he's got, you know, he obviously is going to have a go at the sort of the coalition government in the UK. But he's also angry about things like, you know, or very amusing about going to a Greek restaurant in Liverpool, where he's from Liverpool originally. And the waitress said... He ordered some tiramisu salata, and the waitress says, "I'm sorry, we're out of pita bread. Will wholemeal bread do instead?" And he gets a loaf of sliced bread with his tiramisu salata. So he's very good on all sorts of areas. And I think, as I said, because he hasn't got he's not raging angry. He's more sort of reasoned with his anger. It's a nice show, and it shows. And I think also, you know, there's an idea that, you know, once you're funny, if you've got, there's this concept of funny bones. And I think Alexei Sale had funny bones when he first emerged, and you kind of don't lose those.
Absolutely. Bruce, we were talking with Sergio from Club to Club Festival a little earlier about the artists that he has involved in his festival. Dinos Chapman is there, you know, sort of out of his comfort zone, if you like, looking more at music. And I gather that Jeremy Deller, who is another sort of very, well, I guess a unique talent in the modern art scene, he's also up in Edinburgh.
Yeah, and I mean, it's, you know, as I said, my specialist area is comedy, and his art... is very funny. You know, I saw his show in London a few years ago, and he's just had a show at the Venice representing the UK at the Venice Biennale, if that's how you pronounce it. And he's doing his show here. It's not part of the comedy section in the Fringe, but as I said, I think there'll be lots of comedy in it. And he'll be demonstrating his steam-powered internet machine, which is intriguing. He did a thing last year with an inflatable Stonehenge that he took around the country. So he's very creative. He'll sort of mix and match all sorts of different things. You know, he's had a steel band playing Joy Division songs, and he's had a brass band playing Acid House songs in his shows before. So he always mix and matches and juxtaposes different ideas. So it's always very stimulating.
And is he still quite... I mean, he's quite a political artist, or certainly can be at times. I think of his sort of trades union-influenced works. Is it a political show? I mean, or are many people on that political bent? You mentioned Alexei Sale. There's still that sort of legacy of his angry 80s, sort of almost protest comedy. Is there political comedy? Is that still really happening there, or has everyone mellowed a little?
I think everyone's a bit exhausted by the coalition and the recession, and have used up all their recession jokes, and have used up all their jokes about the Cameron and Clegg. Again, with how many shows? There are about 600 comedy shows on The Fringe, so I guess you could probably find plenty of satire shows if you wanted, but I don't think satire is the big thing. I think it's more kind of silliness that has come into comedy now, and also a lot of comedians, you know, I think you become a comedian because you're quite self-obsessed. So a lot of comedians these days, they're talking about themselves rather than talking about the political situation.
But on that subject, another Edinburgh Festival stalwart, Stuart Lee, I believe is appearing this year in another The Guys.
I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about that, but as you've broached the subject, I will exclusively reveal. Stuart Lee, there's been a character who's been doing low-key shows around the clubs called Bacon Face, who's, again, you know, like Alexei Sale, a comedian from the Canadian comedy circuit from the 1980s, and he wears a mask made out of... It sounds a bit like Lady Gaga, this, doesn't it? He wears a mask made out of fresh bacon.
Hence the nickname.
Hence Bacon Face. And, yes, rumour has it that he's never been seen in the same room as Stuart Lee. Let's just say that. I can't say more than that. I've never seen Stuart Lee and Bacon Face in the same room together. So, and I'm seeing that lunchtime tomorrow. That's interesting. That should be a good one, yeah.
Plenty of big names, as always. You've mentioned a number of them, Bruce. What about Michael Gambon, you know, a legend of the big screen? I gather he's also up in Edinburgh. What's he up to?
This is actually in the International Festival, which, in some ways, the International Festival, which the Fringe Festival came out of the International Festival in the late 40s. And the International Festival's been sort of overshadowed by The Fringe, but it's making a bit of a fight back this year. Michael Gambon's appearing in a Samuel Beckett season, and everyone knows Michael Gambon these days probably as Dumbledore from Harry Potter. But I saw him do a Beckett play a few years ago with Lee Evans. He was in a Beckett play, Endgame, in London. Gambon's, again, one of these characters who's not necessarily sets out to be funny primarily, but is a very great actor and a very funny, charismatic performer. And that's at the International Festival. So that's towards the end of August. But I may well stay around for that if I can bag a ticket.
Absolutely. Well, plenty to enjoy, Bruce. That is Bruce Dessau. Thank you very much for joining us from The Fringe in Edinburgh. Lots of great shows to check out this month up there in Scotland.
And that brings us to the end of our Saturday review. So it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. The show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and Annabelle Bly, and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Zoe Tennant. Our studio manager was Claire Urban.
We're handing back over to Georgina with the weekend edition next. You'll be able to catch our pick of the week's finest cuts from Monocle 24. On The Curator. Don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be air on Sunday at midday London time.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller.
And with me, Tom Edwards. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.